My name is Sarah Slade and I'm Director of the Project Management Office at State Library Victoria. Welcome to the first webinar version of the Policy Pitch, a joint initiative of State Library Victoria and Grattan Institute, which explores public policy for Australia's future. In the pre-COVID world, this event would have been hosted within the newly and beautifully redeveloped library buildings. For now, of course, that's not possible. So thank you for joining us from wherever you may be. State Library Victoria acknowledges that this event and our participants are located on the lands of many traditional custodians in Australia. We pay our respects to Indigenous elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend this respect to any Indigenous participants joining us today. I'd like to give a warm welcome to Friends of the Library, Grattan Institute members, and today's speakers. Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute. Stephen Duckett, Director of Grattan's Health Program. Brendan Coates, Director of Grattan's Household Finances Program. Marion Terrell, Director of Grattan's Transport and Cities Program. And Paul Austin, Editor of Grattan Institute, who will moderate today's discussion. 2020 has been, by all measures, an extraordinary year. As we watched so much of Australia burn in the late months of 2019 and early 2020, it was hard to imagine an event that would be as dramatic or have a greater impact on our nation. Enter a global pandemic. Since March, all our lives have changed profoundly. Things we have long taken for granted, sharing a meal out, hugging family and friends, the availability of toilet paper, have become sources of anxiety, uncertainty, and often sadness. COVID-19 is the biggest social and economic shock since World War II. Federal, state, and territory governments have been furiously working to first slow transmission and save lives, and then to minimise the social and economic damage. But COVID-19 is still very much with us and its impacts will be felt for a long time. So what is the policy framework that will not just provide first aid, but allow Australia to begin its recovery? Our panel of policy experts will lead that discussion today with reference to Grattan Institute's latest publication, The Recovery Book, which identifies the extensive policy agenda Australians' governments should deal with over the next 6 months. And if you've not read it yet, it's a spoiler, it's a very big agenda. While so much depends on broader government response to this crisis, much will also rest with how organisations and individuals adapt. For us in the library world, that means stepping up to the new, urgent and rapidly emerging needs of our communities. Our sector has never been more vital, be it in supplementing formal education and training, in providing opportunities for entrepreneurs and those looking to find new employment, in building community cohesion and resilience, or as places of ideas and inspiration that will be the lifeblood of our long-term prosperity. When hard fundings are made, it's worth keeping in mind that libraries are excellent financial multipliers, returning more than $3 for each dollar invested in them. That's good for the community, it's good for the economy, it's good for the nation's recovery. So with that thought in hand, I'll hand over to Paul to lead today's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And can I join Sarah in welcoming everyone to this special Grattan Institute State Library Victoria webinar on the COVID-19 crisis. As Sarah said, my name is Paul Austin. I'm the editor of the Grattan Institute, and it's my pleasure to be your host for this afternoon's discussion. Our aim over the next hour is to explore how Australia can best handle the recovery phase of the COVID crisis via questions from me to our panel of experts, but also from you, our audience members. But before we talk about recovery, we need to talk about Victoria. So I want to start with you, Stephen Duckett. Stephen is the Health Program Director at Grattan Institute and a former head of the Federal Department of Health. Stephen, we've learnt in the last hour or so that Victoria has just recorded its highest ever daily increase in cases. What's gone wrong in Victoria?
So thanks, Paul. complex question, and I'll give two separate answers because there are two separate answers. The first answer is nothing. Nothing's gone wrong. That is, this spike was to be expected. Once you opened up, once you lifted all the restrictions, while there was still a number of daily new cases in the tens and so on, then it was almost inevitable that you were going to have a spike. And when we did the recovery book and when we did the health program's COVID book the week before, what we said was there will be spikes, and what the government has to do, has to be prepared to do, is lock down again, but also make clear what the criteria were. So the first answer is nothing's gone wrong. The second answer is things have gone wrong. That is, the result that we're seeing today, 127 or so new cases, is a combination of bad luck and bad management. The bad management everybody knows about. It was the failure of quarantine. Quarantine is designed to stop the spread of the disease. The idea is you quarantine people. It means you put them in isolation, lockdown, so the disease doesn't spread. Mm. Well, that's not what happened. We're now going to have an inquiry into precisely what happened, but it's pretty clear that there wasn't sufficient attention to how the lockdown, how the quarantine was supposed to occur, and that's bad management. The second part is there was bad luck. If the guards or whoever who took the infection from the hotels to their homes had only gone to their homes and there was only one other person in their home, then there would have not been the spread. But they went to a party, they went to an event and so on, and so there was further spread, and that's the bad luck part of it. So it's a combination of answers there, Paul, and, you know, the balance is what you have to think about. The balance is what happens next, and then what happens next is there will be further outbreaks. We have to quarantine again, but this time we have to make sure the quarantine works.
Okay, so further outbreaks are to a degree inevitable, Stephen. Should the rest of Australia be prepared for a Victoria-style second wave?
Well, if it does occur, we have to look at the different states differently. We've got some states where they've essentially eliminated the virus. And so they might have a ship land with crew people on it to bring the virus into the country. That would be, again, pretty bad luck and bad management as well. There should be quarantining of these people and not letting them go out. But if you're in a state, Western Australia, for example, where the virus is essentially gone, then you take steps to make sure you don't get it there. And those steps might include stopping these nasty infectious Victorians flying into Perth to bring the virus with them. But if you're in Victoria, New South Wales, until the virus is eliminated, until we have a fortnight or so of zero new cases a day, outbreaks are almost inevitable.
Okay, so in Victoria, New South Wales, outbreaks are almost inevitable. That raises this question, Stephen. Is the Victorian response to this particular second emergency the right one?
What we've argued is that when there's an outbreak, you have to reimpose restrictions. The question is, are the restrictions proportionate? That is, trying to isolate particular postcodes and the housing, public housing estates, which are particular postcodes in a sense. And that has to be part of the response. The government has also rapidly expanded testing, and again, that has to be part of the response. And a significant proportion of those new cases came from the testing program. So lockdown, testing, tracing, that's all part of the deal, and that's what they have to be doing, and that's what they are doing.
And we've also heard, Stephen, just in the last hour, that the Victoria-New South Wales border is now closed. It's a hard lockdown. It raises this question: can the rest of Australia continue to open up, continue to recover, while Melbourne is in such trouble?
Well, obviously, the Victorian economy is a critical engine of the Australian economy as a whole. And so, you know, the lockdown in Victoria has significant national implications. But in a sense, we really have no choice. So, you know, what else do you do? And my view is the decision to shut the borders for those states that have no coronavirus, so have no infections at the moment, is the absolutely the right thing to do, because if they allow infections into those states, they're going to have to lock down, and the impact on the economy is going to be worse from that than than the impact on tourism, essentially, from the border closures.
And Stephen, just before I move on to the other members of the panel, I want to ask you something that's been bugging me since right back in the middle of March, and it's this: why did Australia never go for elimination as the strategy?
It is quite a puzzle. And I think there was different answers for different governments. And so the Victorian government especially pushed hard to have lockdowns. It didn't go total, complete, super-duper lockdown, but it certainly went for a lockdown which was on the elimination end of the policy spectrum. On the other hand, the Commonwealth was always somewhat more relaxed about the threat of the coronavirus, and also less confident about the ability to eliminate. Because until we saw a couple of countries eliminate, it was a question about whether the public would accept that and whether this so-called suppression strategy might be enough to keep the economy ticking over and allow the health system to cope. So sort of balancing those two issues. And so there was always policy conflict. And in the end, my view is we should have seen that lockdown and elimination was the right strategy, and do not lift the restrictions until you've got it right down to zero like they had in those other states.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're watching a special webinar on the COVID-19 crisis with me, Paul Austin, and a panel of Grattan Institute experts, Stephen Duckett, Marion Terrell, Brendan Coates, and Danielle Wood. Danielle, I want to bring you in here. Danielle is the CEO of Grattan Institute as of about 4 hours ago. So first of all, congratulations to you, Danny.
Thank you. Nothing like hitting the ground running with a webinar.
Danielle, and indeed all of our panelists, are co-authors of Grattan's new COVID recovery book, which is now published and which looks a little bit like this. Danielle, what is the recovery book and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Well, you might be able to gather from the copy that Paul's holding up there that it is a fairly weighty tome, 100 pages or so, but really, it's Grattan's perspective on the key policy decisions that both Commonwealth and state governments are going to face over the next 6 to 12 months and what we think that they should do about them. So, you know, we can think about both the virus and the policy responses occurring in different phases. You know, the first phase that we've been in for the last few months is really the rescue phase, where the government was asking the really big questions about the health decisions, what do we lock down and when, the economic decisions, how do we support businesses and households through that lockdown period. But as we come out the other side, or at least we do in some places, as we've already alluded to, the situation's a little bit different in Victoria, but as in other states, restrictions are lifted, we're really transitioning to what we're calling a with COVID world. And there's a whole series of policy decisions that governments need to make to help us successfully transition to a world where we're living with coronavirus. So we were certainly, once we started to think it through, quite shocked at the size of the agenda that the governments are going to have to grapple with. So there's, questions about how we transition off the emergency support measures where they just simply can't continue in the longer term. So things like JobKeeper, mortgage and rent relief for households and businesses, the suspension of some aspects of insolvency laws, all of those things are going to have to come to an end, and what does the transition off those things look like? There are some things that we introduced during the rescue phase that we might want to keep. So telehealth, cheaper childcare, higher levels of unemployment benefits. You know, how do we keep the best parts of those but refine them for a with COVID world? There is, just big questions about how government accommodates changes in the way we work and live. with coronavirus. And, you know, Marion will talk about some of the transport issues, but, you know, a simple one, how do we get people back into the CBDs in a world where public transport is running below capacity? And then on top of this, you know, how do we deal with the economic fallout, you know, in a world when we're in a globally synchronized recession? How do governments respond? So there is a huge agenda there. Getting these decisions right matters and will really determine how well we come out of this and how we look in this post-COVID world. So what we're trying to achieve with the recovery book is really set out what we think is the right agenda for governments to take on, including how they respond to all of those challenges that they're going to have to make calls on sooner rather than later.
Okay, so a huge agenda. A key concept in the recovery book is governments needing to prioritise. What, Danny, does prioritisation mean in the context of the COVID crisis?
Yeah, it certainly, you know, throws some of the normal concepts on their head. So normally when we think about prioritisation, we're thinking, well, what are the policy changes that would give the government the best bang for buck in terms of whatever they're trying to achieve, given the constraints they face in terms of dollars, in terms of bureaucratic resources, in terms of political capital? What the recovery book really drives home is that the forward agenda is so full. You know, the things that governments need to make decisions on in the next 6 to 12 months, you know, as I said, transitioning off the emergency measures, stimulus to support the economy, managing health, education, transport systems in the with COVID world, it is such a full agenda that there is just going to be less scope to do the things that are important but are less urgent. So, you know, the first time a journalist asked me what COVID meant for tax reform, it was a week after the JobKeeper package was announced, and I almost fell off my chair. I thought, you know, the pictures of those unemployment queues were still so fresh in my mind. I thought, you know, I love talking about tax reform as much as the next person, but why are we talking about this now? And, you know, there's a huge range of issues like that. They are important. They will be important for the recovery in the long term. But in a world where we have constrained resources, we need to focus on getting these urgent things right, because that's what's really going to drive how we come out of this.
Okay, so here's a big question for you, Danny. Do you think Australia's governments and institutions are up to this enormous challenge?
Look, I am optimistic, but obviously there are potential risks. Look, I think we have performed relatively well today, certainly not perfectly, and we all have our areas where we would have done things differently with the benefit of hindsight, but I think pretty well. And I think that's, you know, partly because our governments, both Commonwealth and state, have performed very competently. You know, they've listened to the experts, they've been pragmatic, they've made the hard decisions, and that's actually brought a lot of public goodwill. So I've certainly been looking at data on trust in government for a number of years. Basically, it's kind of been a downward slide for about a decade, and what we're seeing is actually an incredible turnaround in those figures. You know, trust in all public institutions is up, but it's particularly up in our parliaments, in our federal and state parliaments. So, you know, they are coming into this recovery period with significant political goodwill. The other point I would make on the institutions is I think our public service has served us very well through this period. You know, it was only a couple of months before COVID that the Prime Minister was saying politicians would do the policy thinking and the public service was there to implement. I think we have seen the benefit here of a public service that is good at policy design and coming up with policy quickly. And the government has been listening to them on those points. You know, we've seen the Chief Medical Officer standing side by side with the Prime Minister during press conferences. You know, we've seen an economic response which has Treasury's fingerprints all over it. And so I think having those strong institutions there to support the government does give me some optimism. On the risks, you know, I think the biggest risk is the one that we've already pointed to, that the government tries to take on too many things, including non-urgent things. And, you know, if you look at the announcement around changes to university supports from government and changes to course fees for students a couple of weeks ago, I think that's a really good example of that. You know, yes, there was an issue there to be solved around the fact that we know that more students are going to be hitting universities, more domestic students are going to be hitting universities in the next couple of years. But they took on that battle with, you know, some very significant changes that don't look like they're well structured to serve the underlying policy goal that they expressed. They're being put onto universities during a time when they're already facing significant disruption. So I think the risk of trying to take on those upper battles could potentially derail us off the right course. The other risk, I think, is that some of these health and economic decisions become, you know, too politicised. Yes, you want governments held to account for their decisions, but I think oppositions have in the main taken a pretty constructive approach to date. What we do not want is the kind of, either the health or economic issues becoming culture war type issues. So, if you look at the US, where I can tell who you vote for whether you wear a mask or not in public, that is not a good state to be in. So, I certainly hope we avoid going down that track.
So it's a worrying, it's a bewildering, it's a sad time in all of our lives, really, Danny. Do you believe young Australians in particular can have any optimism about their future?
Yes, as you say, it's an incredibly challenging time for everyone, but I think particularly so for young people. And, it doesn't matter what statistics you look at, it bears that out. Young people have been disproportionately hit by job losses. Unemployment amongst young people, headline unemployment is over 16% compared to just over 7% in the general population. And we know that masks the true extent of the problem because of JobKeeper and the rising problem of underemployment. Mental health issues are on the rise again for everyone, but particularly amongst the young. And there was some really, very concerning data coming out of Swinburne University today about just how much anxiety, depression, stress is on the up amongst the under 25s. I don't think I want to say anything that underplays the challenge. The only point I would make is that governments have some tools that can really help here. And that is why, we made such a strong point in the recovery book about the importance of them using those tools and the importance of deploying monetary policy, of making commitment to significant fiscal stimulus, because that is what is going to create jobs. And that's really what's going to help young people to get back to something that looks like life is normal. So what we don't want is, what is a short-term shock becoming a long-term hit to those people's lives, and government should be using every tool that they have to stop that from happening.
Thanks, Danny. Now, Brendan, can I bring you in here? Brendan Coates is the Director of the Household Finances Program at Grattan. Brendan, the recovery book recommends big stimulus spending over coming months and indeed years. There's been a lot of stimulus about recently, Brendan. Why do we need more?
Paul, you're right. Frankly, some incredible numbers. So we're talking about we've spent $160 billion so far on what I wouldn't just describe as stimulus, but more support for the economy, because what we've largely done is consistent with, what the Prime Minister has said. We've tried to build a bridge to the other side as the economy's been in hibernation. So a lot of those payments are basically replacing the incomes that people would otherwise have, but they don't because, frankly, their industries have been shut down while we've tried to control the spread of COVID. But even that spending is enormous, but the challenge we face is enormous. So some of the numbers Danny was talking about before about unemployment, we haven't seen some of these numbers since the Great Depression. So, this is the worst economic crisis that we've seen for at least, 40 years, and probably 90 years. So we do think that more will be needed, because at its heart, at the end of the day, even if you do manage to reopen, as we've seen in Victoria, that's an uneven and uncertain process. You're going to be left with a classic recession where there'll be just a lack of demand in the economy. Unemployment is expected to remain high for a long time. So even on the Reserve Bank's numbers, which are now starting to get a bit old, their forecasts unemployment to still be at 6.5% by mid-2022. Deloitte Access had a report out today where they're expecting the jobless rate to remain above the levels it was pre-COVID until 2024, which is 4 years away. Mm-hmm. And we know that unemployment has big effects on the economy. It hurts. There is the process of scarring where Australians younger Australians are hurt by having sustained periods outside the labour market. And we do know that overall the economy is weaker if you have a sustained high period of unemployment. Now, the reason we're calling for stimulus is there's frankly few other options. So, you can do things like, try to do structural reform, tax reform. That's great. We'll support that. But the challenge is that it doesn't really solve your demand problem in the short term. In fact, it tends to actually go the other way and make it worse. At the same time, monetary policy, there's only so much the Reserve Bank can do. It's approaching the zero lower bound. It can probably go a bit further and cut rates further. But even if it did everything we could conceivably imagine it doing, we're not going to see the economy roaring back anytime soon. And so it's really incumbent upon governments to try to use fiscal policy, use stimulus to get the economy back and operating at full potential as, frankly, as soon as we can.
Okay, so I wonder if you could describe for us, Brendan, what I might call the Grattan stimulus package.
So the Grattan package is very straightforward, which is to say that we think you should be aiming to bring unemployment down to between 4 and 5% within the next couple of years. And to do that, based on the kinds of forecasts, we think you need something like $70 to $90 billion of spending over largely the next 18 months to bring unemployment down by 1.5 percentage points from where it would otherwise be. And that would create something like 400,000 to 500,000 extra jobs over that time. Now, we think, obviously, that there are three parts to that support. So that 70 to 90 billion, we would say about 30 billion of it should be extending the existing supports that are otherwise going to come off in September. That's extending JobSeeker and expanding it, extending JobKeeper and expanding it and gradually phasing down JobSeeker. We do think there are some changes that have been made during COVID that are worth keeping. So we think a permanently higher job seeker rate, ongoing reforms to childcare subsidies, and also something we think should happen is higher rent assistance would be about $20 billion over the next 2 years. And then you're left with discretionary stimulus, you know, cash payments to households, social housing, spending on small scale infrastructure of about $20 to $40 billion. And together, that's $70 to $90 billion, and that would hopefully get the economy back towards full employment. And if it didn't, then we would probably need to spend more because there aren't any alternatives that governments really have in the toolkit in order to get the economy growing again.
Okay, so 70 to 90 billion at least over the next couple of years. Let's break it down a bit, Brendan. What precisely do you recommend should happen to JobKeeper, the big one?
So we think JobKeeper has been quite an effective policy designed in an incredibly short period of time to basically starve off economic disaster. But in the benefit of hindsight, there are some things that we would change. And also, there is this looming fiscal cliff in September, October, we need to worry about. So the first thing we would do is we would extend JobKeeper so it would beyond September for those firms that haven't fully recovered. So you would essentially retest businesses' turnover in July and September. And if they're still substantially below where they were pre-COVID in September, then you would extend the payment to those businesses through to the end of the year. And now, even if we all goes well in terms of relaxing spatial distancing, it's unlikely we're going to see huge crowds at the footy in all states. It's unlikely you're going to see large music venues unless you've fully eradicated COVID. And so there'll be a lot of businesses that will be really struggling through that period and will need that support. But in the long term, we shouldn't keep that payment forever because it does have the effect of making it harder for people to move to new jobs. And at some point, that has to change. Beyond that, we also think JobKeeper should be reformed. So it should be paid in advance rather than arrears. So this has been a big problem in firms taking up the payment. We now have businesses in the system and in the scheme. And so it would simply be a case of switching to paying that money in advance. So 1 month, you get two lots of the payment, the business would, and then they would be able to pay their workers without having to cover it out of their own reserves. Second, JobKeeper should be extended to cover short-term casuals, temporary migrants, and the university workers. You know, there's no real strong economic reasons why that hasn't happened already. And in fact, it's meaning that a lot of firms in a lot of sectors that have a high reliance, say, on temporary migrants, frankly, just don't have access to or can't get that wage subsidy for their workers. And it's adding to the downturn that they're experiencing. And so those are the things we really think should happen on JobKeeper. And if we did that, then it would really support the economy and support businesses through the next sort of 6 months as we hopefully start to recover from COVID.
At JobSeeker, Brendan, how should that be reformed or refined?
So we think JobSeeker should work in concert with JobKeeper to try to manage this transition. As I said before, JobKeeper, it does have some drawbacks as a policy. You know, the subsidy is tied to staying with the existing firm. Now, in a lot of cases, you won't stay with that employer in the long term because, you know, if you're working for an airline, we're probably not expecting airlines to come back in full force for quite a long time. And so we do need at some point to see a resorting of workers in the economy. but without having seen their spending and their incomes decline, which would be a recipe for a second downturn. So what we think should happen with JobSeeker is it should stay at the current rate of with the coronavirus supplement, which is roughly $1,100 a fortnight, through to the end of the year, so that those that do come off JobKeeper, say in September, their income falls from $1,500 a fortnight down to $1,100. It's not such a big shock as they would otherwise have. And then when they get to the end of the year, then we start to see the job seeker rate start to come down. So we would gradually transition it down from January through March to a new permanent, higher permanent rate of job seeker that's at least $100 a week higher than what it was before. So it's something like $760 a fortnight rather than $560 previously. And that would, we think that increase is justified on the basis that JobSeeker is now far, far below the poverty line, to the point where a lot of Australians anecdotally who are on it struggle to actually be able to be work ready. We don't think there's a real problem at the moment with a lack of people, or with that kind of rate, there wouldn't be a problem with a lack of people looking for work, essentially because it would still be, you know, roughly half the minimum wage. And at the moment, we're probably not going to see a huge amount of job opportunities in the coming months relative to the number of Australians that will be searching for work.
Brendan, you won't be surprised to know that the discussion of stimulus has prompted a few questions from our viewers. Let me throw a couple of them to you. Graham asks, or says, you're clearly going to be slammed by the current government with how do we pay for all this? How do you respond to that, Brendan?
So it's worth keeping in mind, first of all, the hit to the stimulus impact on the budget or the debt position is not that large. You know, we shouldn't sniff at spending money that would that is 3 to 4% of GDP. But you know, in the long run, the hit to public debt as a share of GDP, even a decade away, would be relatively small. Now, in a lot of cases, that debt doesn't necessarily need to be paid for quite a long time because the interest rate in the economy, sorry, the interest rate on that debt is lower than the rate of economic growth, and therefore, you know, you won't see spiraling debt and deficits coming out of the stimulus. And as I said before, there aren't really any alternatives. So if it's a choice between slightly higher debt to GDP versus sustained high unemployment that frankly destroys the lives of a large number of young Australians, I think it's actually a relatively easy and straightforward choice.
Related question, Brendan, for you from Michael. Can you defend the large and permanent increase in government spending and the size of government that would occur under the Grattan package?
So the permanent increase in spending comes from the childcare subsidies and from the job seeker payment. Mm-hmm. That's about something like $8 to $10 billion, about $10 billion a year ongoing. Now, that is something like 0.5% of GDP in the context of federal government or government budgets that, you know, government's typically spending, you know, 20% plus of GDP. I think we will need to have a reckoning about how we actually pay for the costs of some of these reforms and the costs of the COVID-19 crisis on the budget. But that's a conversation to have in future. We don't have a firm view about what the size of government should be, but instead we would be looking at the kinds of reforms to our parts of the tax system, to spending, that look at essentially sharing the burden, the budgetary burden of COVID-19 across the community as a whole.
Thanks, Brendan. Marion Terrell, I want to bring you in here. Marion is the Transport and Cities Program Director at Grattan. Marion, this crisis really is changing everything, isn't it? It's changing the way we live, the way we travel, the way we work.
That's right. It's changing it a lot. If you cast your mind back to before COVID, think about what work was like. Most people drove to work. So in Sydney, 2/3 of people drove to work, and in Melbourne and Brisbane, about 3/4 of people drove to work. The CBDs are a bit different. Before the pandemic, most commuters took public transport to work in the CBD. But don't forget, most people don't work in the CBD, only about 15% of jobs in Sydney and Melbourne, 12% in Brisbane. So that's what it was like before, but it all feels very different now. I think the big one, of course, is that there's a lot more working from home. Before the pandemic, only about 5% of people worked from home, but now things have changed so much. And The estimates I've seen are that about 40% of jobs can be done from home, and at the moment, most of them are being done from home. But we're no longer really at the very dead levels of activity that we were seeing back in the middle of April in the absolute doldrums. We are starting to see activity levels pick up a bit. So by the end of June, movement and crowding in the CBD of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane was back to somewhere like a third to a half of what normal looks like, whereas it had been down below 20% of normal back in the very low point in April. We're also seeing a bit of a pickup in movement levels around suburban railway stations. So people are getting around by public transport more than they were. It had got virtually to a standstill at 10% of normal levels or even less back in mid-April. But now we're seeing a pickup to around half of normal levels by the end of June in Sydney and Brisbane, around a quarter to a third in Melbourne, which is interesting because that's been a consistent trend that predates the recent difficulties that we've seen in Melbourne. So I think the bottom line, Paul, is that in terms of the changes in how we live and move around, what we've seen is people have adapted really quickly. So on the way down, most of the reduction in activity levels happened before the restrictions were imposed. And now on the way up, a lot of the pickup in activity also happened before restrictions have been lifted. So I think the implication here really is that people are very adaptable. So they're clearly taking into account official rules and guidance, but they are also making judgments about what's safe for themselves and those they care about.
Okay, so people are adapting and we're changing the way we live, but what are these changes mean for city planners, for policymakers in Australia? What are the lessons that they need to learn, Marion?
So we're a very long way from a stable end state. So we don't know if and when there's going to be a vaccine. So we're living with a very high level of uncertainty, and that's got to translate into what it means for city planners and how cities operate. What's more immediately in front of us is the path out of lockdown, including in cases like what we're seeing today in Victoria, where it's two steps forward and two steps back again. I think the most important implication, though, is about these patterns of travel and movement. So in a nutshell, what I think we're going to see is public transport patronage down for as long as distancing continues. And while we might see more working from home and we might see more cycling, I think we are also going to see more driving. So basically, just to give you a bit more detail about that, I think public transport is all about efficiently moving large numbers of people, and it's just not compatible with social distancing. So I think, but it's still important because some people don't have a viable alternative, and we don't want everyone to take to their cars because it brings its own difficulties. So I think there's a strong imperative on state governments who are doing more frequent cleaning and sanitising, but only in Sydney is there really any notion of enforcing passenger limits. We're certainly not seeing some of the stronger measures that are happening overseas, like compulsory mask wearing or even compulsory temperature checks, that sort of thing. So there's certainly more that could be done on public transport, and we'll see how that goes. In terms of cycling, I think there is a bit of activity in Sydney and Melbourne to make more space, temporary cycle lanes, to improve the safety, not from the virus, but from cars and trucks. And that's clearly very important. But again, a lot of cities around the world are making these changes permanent. So that'll be an interesting one for city planners. But I think the big one really is the fact that a lot of people are going to prefer to drive. They will feel safer to drive. So there's a disaster in the making if we don't do anything about this. And my proposal is that the best and most efficient way to do something about it is to introduce congestion charging. So I'm proposing a cordon charge around the CBD of the major cities, charging drivers a fee to enter in the morning peak, a fee to leave in the afternoon peak. And what that does is it doesn't stop people from going where they need to go, but it does kind of encourage people who can be flexible about when or where or how they travel to be flexible so that we don't grind to a halt. I think a lot of people are calling for more working from home. As I said, very few people did this before the pandemic. It seems like a lot of people are itching to get back to the office. So working from home is certainly not for all jobs and it's not for all people. But it does seem more viable than a lot of people thought it was before. Ultimately, a commercial decision for businesses to make. But I do think it's one behavioural trend that may be with us to stay.
Marion, a very practical question for you about public transport. Can I ever feel safe again catching a train or a tram or a bus to work, do you think?
Well, at the moment, if you decided not to do that, you would not be alone. I think a lot of people are voting with their feet. I think the latest data is showing these pickups of levels, but I think it remains to be seen. What's important here is to make public transport as safe as possible for people who rely on it. So in Sydney, they've got limits of 68 people per train carriage and 33 people per bus, and they've got extra services and so forth. Melbourne and Brisbane haven't imposed these passenger limits at this point. So there's more that could be done. I think public transport operators do see this potentially as a bit hard to do, but I think if you think about what's happening elsewhere, in Paris, for example, people are being issued permits if they want to go on public transport to manage numbers. There's a reservation system in Beijing. I think, to your question, Paul, about whether you'll ever feel safe again, I think we are not out of the woods yet. There are plenty of people avoiding public transport, and it's set to get really challenging once people who are currently working from home start to get back to the office in greater numbers.
Okay, now I'm going to run around the panel as best I can with a range of questions from you, our audience. There's lots of them, so let's get to it. Firstly, I'll start with you, Stephen. Question from Emily. Should Australians, you've heard this question before, Stephen, should Australians wear masks in public?
So my short answer is the evidence about masks is pretty good, that we should be wearing them. Certainly my view is that we should be wearing them on public transport and also on planes. Someone asked that question. So, you know, you're sitting in close proximity indoors. So I think masks should be compulsory on public transport and on planes. Whether you should be wearing masks everywhere is a moot point. We went to Vic Market the weekend before last and we wore masks because it was a crowded place, even though most of it is essentially outdoors, and that was for our own protection. So I wouldn't make masks compulsory everywhere, but I'd certainly look to see them compulsory in public transport.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. Another question to you, another thematic question which you've heard before. This one, particular one, comes from Petta. Are we any closer to a vaccine?
I'm not a gambling person, so it's a pure speculation. There are a lot of companies investing a lot of money in developing a vaccine because essentially the market is going to be huge, and so there's a huge commercial reward. However, it's a hard vaccine to develop because of the nature of the coronavirus, and so I wouldn't think that I think the likelihood of developing a vaccine in the next 6 months, I would say is less than 50-50, but, you know, I can be proved wrong.
Thanks, Stephen. One for you, Marion, that arises from your contribution. You're recommending a congestion tax. Christine has got a question. What about smaller cars rather than a congestion tax to help free up our roads?
Yes, that's a great suggestion. There's actually a suite of things that can be done to reduce or to help manage congestion and still allow people to get to where they need to go. And I think smaller cars are a great idea. If you travel overseas, one of the things that is very striking is that in most big cities, people drive really small vehicles if they drive at all. But here, Australians have very big cars and they're getting bigger. So in some states, there's a slightly more expensive vehicle registration for bigger cars, but not in all, not in Victoria. And that having the fleet smaller doesn't just mean it's less dangerous for pedestrians and cyclists, but parking bays don't need to be so big. Our parking bays are very big by international standards. That's on the street. Even the lanes that we have are very big, very wide by international standards. They wouldn't meet, so that we could run the infrastructure a lot harder. We could get a lot more people moving per meter of tarmac if we didn't have such large vehicles. Of course, having one person in vehicles is also a big part of the problem, but smaller vehicles, I think, are a very good part of a solution.
Question to you, Brendan, on the superannuation industry. This comes from Trent, who makes the point that we've just ticked over into a new financial year and certain people under certain conditions have been given further access to their superannuation savings in the new financial year. What broadly, Brendan, is happening with superannuation at the moment, and will we look at superannuation differently once all this is over?
Thanks, Paul. So obviously the superannuation early release scheme has allowed Australians to take $10,000 last financial year and up to $10,000 this financial year from the superannuation. If they meet a set of criteria, or essentially you've lost your job or sustained a big fall in your income. I think what it's done is it's provided a lot of support to people who otherwise may have struggled to get by. Government supports by JobSeeker and JobKeeper have been pretty unprecedented, but there are still gaps. And some people will need more support, and they providing that or allowing people to access that was a good idea. That said, you know, there are suggestions and certainly some anecdotal evidence that people are taking money out that probably don't meet the criteria. So the first thing we should do is to tighten those up. So you should be required to prove that you've in fact experienced this shortfall or this loss before you can access the money. That wasn't probably the right approach for the first round because we just had to get the money out the door so quickly. But for the second round, JobKeeper and JobSeeker are in place. You know, we should delay it and be a bit more careful. More broadly, I think what it's shown is that, you know, super's a trade-off between money in retirement versus money now. And COVID, I think, has really emphasized the importance of money in your pocket now. And that trade-off, I think, still will certainly hold. So going forward, we certainly say that the legislated increase in compulsory super to 12% shouldn't go ahead. It would force Australians to save for more in future than what they have now. It'll hurt the budget in the long term. And it will mean lower wages growth today, which, you know, wages are already going to be growing pretty slowly in the next few years, particularly if governments don't do more on the stimulus front.
Okay, another one for you, Brendan, from Tony. You talk in the recovery book about a return to full employment, back to around about 5% unemployment within the next 2 years. Tony suggests that sounds pretty heroic just at the moment. How is 5% unemployment in Australia a realistic goal at the moment?
Well, I think in the same way as we saw unemployment shoot up over the last couple of months, you can expect that it could come back down pretty quickly. It's worth noting that, you know, the number we're really aiming for is the rate of unemployment. It's, the NIRU, which is the rate at which inflation and wages start to grow or start to accelerate. The RBA expects that's in previous research around 4.5% with a fair probability it's between 4 and 5. We frankly won't know where it is until we get there. So what we should be doing is stimulating the economy until we get to that rate of unemployment. And then you'll start to see inflation rise. And at the moment, the risks are probably towards deflation. So that's not a bad thing. And wages will start to rise. And then, you know, you can probably start to withdraw some of that stimulus and be confident that you've kind of hit the number. We won't know until, frankly, we get there.
Stephen, one for you from Greg. Reference to the Victorian crisis. We've seen over the weekend this grave decision by the Victorian government to lock down Housing Commission towers in Melbourne. That terrible situation raises many, many questions. But Greg notes that the chief health officer or the chief medical officer in Canberra has likened high-rise towers to vertical cruise ships. Does this mean we need to have lower density living in future? Are high-rise for the rich, for the poor? Are they out of the question in a world with COVID?
So the high-rise towers, the risks, I saw that comment about vertical cruise ships, and I thought that was a good one. Right. But what we have in the high-rise towers is not only a whole lot of, in a sense, apartments or flats in those buildings, but also significant overcrowding. So you've got the average number of people per apartment is actually on the high end. And so it is a sign of inadequate social or public housing generally. So this is not my area, but I wouldn't say whether, you know, the high rise per se is the issue, but certainly it's a sign that we haven't got adequate social or public housing because of this overcrowding we're seeing.
And Danielle, a question for you from Kate. She notes that childcare was for a period during this crisis made free, as it were, by the government. Should childcare remain free into the future? Isn't that a better system?
Look, that would be a dramatic change to the system. So it was introduced as an emergency measure, and the challenge that childcare centres were facing was that a lot of people, because they were concerned about health or because they lost their job or lost hours of pulling their children out of childcare, we know that they need actually pretty high rates of utilisation to be economic. So the government's response was to introduce free childcare. That was certainly very effective as a short-term response, and we actually would have liked to see that continue on a little bit longer. We're going back to the old system on the 12th of July, and there's a lot of dangers, I think, for the sector with that. What we would like to see, rather than free childcare, at least in the as we come out of this phase, is a significant boost to the childcare subsidy. We have very high out-of-pocket costs for childcare in Australia compared to most other developed nations. We know that is a big drag on workforce participation, and we have some work coming out in August just to show how significant that is. So for many families, if they've got a couple of children in childcare, one parent working full-time, normally the father, one parent working part-time, quite often the mother, there is almost no financial incentive, i.e. you don't take home, you take home $2 an hour or sometimes nothing, if you go from 3 to 4 or 4 to 5 days work after you factor in additional tax, fallback of welfare benefits and increase in childcare costs. So the current system, the world that we're snapping back to, is a big drag on work incentives. So we would like to see a significant redesign of that system where you're upping the base level of the subsidy and reducing the rate at which it gets clawed back. So you're actually providing a genuine incentive for people who want to work more, and you get a real economic kicker with that as well.
Danielle, another one I'm going to ask to you. This is from Pete. And he asks a pretty straightforward, pretty blunt question. Is there a class issue with COVID-19? And I guess what Pete might be referring to is that in the early days of this crisis, here in Victoria where I live, we were hearing of cases in Toorak and in Portsea and in the private schools. And now, 3, 4, 5 months later, we're closing down high-rise subsidised housing commission flats. Is there a class issue here, Danielle?
Look, I'm not as qualified to talk about the health response, but I've certainly heard the criticism that the very strong response that has been brought into play with those high-rise flats may not have happened if that happened in a different area. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to grapple with, and obviously there were some pretty significant health issues that the government was bringing into play. Where there is clearly, I think, a class issue is in terms of the economic fallout. We've talked about the fact that young people are disproportionately represented in the job loss numbers, as are those that tend to earn lower incomes. And that's because the sectors that have been on the front line of this Hospitality, arts, tourism, recreation, they tend to be lower paid occupations on average. So there is greater fallout for people on lower incomes. The government support packages have been extremely helpful in that regard. The boost to JobSeeker, JobKeeper, we've actually seen some low-income people, particularly part-time workers, get a pay rise because that is a flat payment. So that's really helping keep people afloat for the moment. The big question that Brendan was pointing to is what happens at the end of September when those payments come off, and can we make sure that there are appropriate supports in place for those people if they haven't managed to get back into the workforce come September 30?
Stephen Duckett, can I throw that question to you as well? I think it's a fascinating question from Pete. Is there a class issue with COVID? Does this disease, this virus, affect the poor more than the rich? And is government response different depending on which class, if you like, of the community is being hit?
Well, Paul, if you look at the postcodes that have been locked down, they're not the wealthiest postcodes in Melbourne.
Indeed.
Speaking of a Melbourne perspective. And there's a combination of factors here too. These are often postcodes where there's housing overcrowding. These are often postcodes where people can't work from home, tradies and people in face-to-face industries. And so that increases the risk. Now, so the former of those is a class issue, the second one is not. So I think there's a bit of a combination. We're now in a phase of the pandemic where there's much tougher action being taken. And so when our friends came back from Aspen and tootled around Portsea, they were just told to go home and self-isolate, whereas now the action of government is very strong. And so we are seeing a difference in perspective. But I think, as I said, the postcodes which are most affected now are the ones which are lower socioeconomic class, and it's a combination of factors.
Now, we're getting close to time, but I want to finish by asking you, Danielle Wood, what's next for Grattan Institute? What's on the agenda over the coming weeks and months, particularly with regard to the COVID crisis?
So obviously the recovery book was a huge piece of work, bringing together the work across so many different Grattan programs. So we will be absolutely staying active in these debates. As I think I said before, the policy choices we make in this period are going to be absolutely crucial for how we come out on the other side. So Grattan feels that we have a really important role to play in continuing to advocate for sensible policy in a lot of these areas. We are also thinking longer term, and obviously, as I said, there are a lot of issues that maybe aren't a priority in the next 6 to 12 months, but there will be important questions on the other side of this about, what kind of world we see ourselves living in. There'll be questions about economic reform, there'll be questions about social changes, there'll be questions about, issues like climate change. So Grattan is thinking we will do another publication like this, a big Grattan-wide publication, focusing on that rebuild phase. After we come out the side of the recovery phase, what should governments be thinking about when we're looking about how we rebuild Australia? So that's something that we would not release until well into next year, but that's certainly something that I've got on the agenda for us as an organisation.
Thanks, Danielle. And thank you, Stephen, Marion and Brendan. And thank you to you. Thank you to our host and our partner, the State Library of Victoria, and Sarah, and to you, our audience members. If you found today's webinar valuable, you can let your friends and colleagues know that they'll be able to watch it from later this afternoon on Grattan's website and social media channels. Please keep in touch with the Grattan Institute and the State Library of Victoria via our websites. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and thanks for watching.